Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is one of our oldest friends and a great thinker on all of this, E.J. McMahon, who is an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank based in Albany. He writes on regional, state, and local issues, recommending policy changes and reforms to increase economic growth. Welcome back, E.J. McMahon.
Thank you.
EJ, let's start in the beginning. We've got a tax bill out there.
Right.
How's that going to affect New York?
Well, it will affect New York negatively in the sense that it repeals the state and local itemized tax deduction. And that basically, we're among a handful of high tax states where that deduction is worth the most. We have higher income. We have more higher income payers, many of whom fall into the regional definition of middle class, downstate mainly, who will get a much smaller tax cut, if any, out of this than people with similar sort of levels of lifestyle in less expensive parts of the country. In general, it's not good for New York. And in general, on a principled basis, it's not good to repeal the state and local tax deduction. So that's a problem.
So we see that the none other than Mitch McConnell, as we speak today on a Thursday,
right.
Mitch McConnell and the Senate and the House are duking it out,
right.
As to what should be in the bill. McConnell says there should be a higher deductibility of state and local taxes.
Well, that's immaterial. Those are just sort of symbolic measures because those are deductions people could take as an alternative to the standard deduction, which
right.
for almost nobody would make any difference. Nobody would be able to choose it anyway. Those are all symbolic measures. What this really is, by the way, and the marketing of House Republicans from the outset by Speaker Ryan has billed this as a middle class tax cut. It's actually a corporate tax cut. It's basically the middle class tax cut is the lead to drag in the corporate tax cut. Now, there's bipartisan agreement on corporate tax cuts. Some of the partisan rhetoric that has said, these are Republicans trying to grease up their business friends. Obama favored a corporate tax cut and proposed one. We have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the developed world, if not the highest. There's widespread agreement on a need to overhaul the corporate tax system to close a lot of loopholes and to reduce the rate, which
partially
is now 35%.
Partially, EJ, and you can say that again, but partially because not everybody pays the announced
right.
rate.
Right, because there's so many loopholes that the effective rate is much lower than the statutory rate of 35%, and it was encouraging a lot of multinational companies to offshore their income and their operations. There's widespread agreement, bipartisan agreement in Washington to do something. If this had been focused solely on that, you would be looking at probably a bipartisan agreement to reduce the corporate rate, probably not to 28, which Obama proposed, probably to at least 25. Trump made this sort of totem of making getting it all the way down to 20, which some people I think would agree is probably even more than is necessary. The whole thing was also billed as, but they billed it as a middle class tax cut. Now, the other thing they did was they billed it as tax simplification. Remember months ago, which seems like years ago now, they said, how about you could put your taxes on a postcard? Well, it's actually going to be tax complication. It's actually going to further complexify the tax code, especially but not only on the business side, but on the individual side.
Because how so?
It's just going to be a different set of rules and itemized deductions that are available to you if and or but certain circumstances apply.
But they're expecting that most people won't itemize, right?
They're expecting that fewer people will itemize, and they're correct. Fewer people will itemize. But it's not going to be a postcard tax return. And the complexity on the business end and among the higher income folks is going to probably get worse.
So let me ask the self-serving question that's on many of our minds here at non-for-profit institutions.
Right.
We expect that fewer people will be taking the itemized deduction,
right.
Therefore fewer people will be giving money because to places like public radio, public television,
right.
Metropolitan Museum of Art, because they know
right.
that they're not going to get the deduction.
Right. I think that that's interesting that that has not been talked about much.
Talking about it here.
But I run a tax exempt organization to which contributions are tax deductible, and I've begun thinking about that a little bit myself, because unless you're very high income, the highest income people, it will remain a factor. In fact, it'll be the only big deduction that they take that they'll have left. But for people who are moderate means or even of relatively affluent means, it's going to be much less important to them from the standpoint of a deduction. Now, there's been research done on this, I assure you know, as an executive of a nonprofit, that indicates, well, it's not that important, but it does weigh. I know myself, I've gone to the end of the year sometimes and say, gotten a small bonus or some check for some work of a few hundred dollars and thought, well, whoops, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Go ahead.
I thought, well, you know, what the heck, let's up our contribution to blank, because I like them and I want to support them anyway, and I don't, you know, I think I'm, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to be owing more money on my tax next year. I think that's something people think about who itemize.
And we'll be able to see, this is going to be a great academic experience, because this year they'll be able to deduct. Next year
they won't. No,
and we'll be able to see what the difference is.
By the way, yes, all of you out there, the window is closing. You've got 3 weeks to make a fully deductible contribution to the Empire Center or to the public radio station of your choice, Alan hopes is WAMC. I think that's one of the many interesting things here. This is really complicated and brings us into uncharted waters in a lot of ways. And again, back to the politics of it for New York, you know, the hope is that the corporate tax cut is something that gooses the economy a bit. I tend to think it'll be a relatively modest boost, if any, and most people agree that it'll be in there. If any, it'll be in the earlier, it'll be in the next couple of years and not enduring.
Now, EJ, you're known as a fairly conservative guy. I don't know that that's fair, but that's sort of the reputation.
I won't run for that description.
You've garnered. And yet, here you are, you know, thinking about New York State, where you work. And the idea of tax cuts. And so it's got to be a little bit perplexing tug of war.
Well, I've written about this in the past. In 2012, this is almost forgotten now, Obama and then Speaker Boehner had cut a deal that would have significantly capped the state and local tax deduction for high income people in New York and other states that depend heavily on high income payers. That was the done deal in the 2012 deal 5 years ago now. That deal went into a weekend, and in the Senate, then still controlled by Democrats, Schumer killed it quietly, almost out of the media's notice. It was the most underreported story of the era. It's been threatened before. It was threatened 30 years ago. I've always thought that from a conservative standpoint, more than any standpoint, that the state and local tax deduction is worth preserving. And now, again, that's conflict for me. I spent most of my adult working life, certainly since leaving journalism and going to policy analysis, criticizing our high levels of spending and taxing as a fiscal conservative. I don't like the levels of spending and taxation in New York, and I have had a lot to say about it. But philosophically, from a federalist standpoint, your gut level of government closest to you should have first dibs on your dollar. And by the way, your vote counts for more, and your voice is heard best at the level closest to you also. The notion that the feds are not going to waste money as effectively as the state does is ridiculous. If anything, it's the opposite.
First of all, we're talking to E.J. McMahon, the brilliant E.J. McMahon. E.J., I wanted to talk to you a moment about, into all of this comes writing out of the West, I believe. That's where Lock and Bar came from. Andrew Cuomo.
Right.
What's his visibility? What's his exposure? What's he got to worry about?
Well, I mean, the way he's handled this, I don't think he's covered himself in glory or honor in the way he's dealt with this. As governor of New York, he needs to be concerned about this, and he has a right to object to it and to raise an alarm over it as being something that's bad for New York.
That the blue states are being punished.
And he's right. The motive is purely, the reason it's happening now, above all, the motive is overwhelmingly political among Republicans in Congress. This is the payfer, as they say in Washington, where they can get some money to offset some of the costs of what they really want to do, which is cut the corporate rate deeper than they could have done before. However, what did you not see him do? We're not the only state with high taxes. Was an effort made to come up with a substantive critique of this? Did he seek an opportunity for a major speech outlining why, in fact, it's in the best interest of the nation to preserve the state and local tax deduction? Did he work through the National Governors Association with governors in other states in both parties who have Republican congressmen in their ranks and tell them why, let's join together and let's explain why this is not just us, let's talk about it, like the governor of North Carolina, like the governor of Minnesota. These are places with Republican congressional representatives. There's 12 votes to flip would have defeated it in the House. That has not been what's happened. He is just—
Why not?
You'd need a psychological examination of him to figure out why. And his
I'm always willing
motives.
To do that.
You're willing to do that.
I think what's happening is he wants to run for president of the United States and he doesn't want to share with others.
Well, here's the thing. What would make him bigger, win or lose on this? What would make a better impression on a broader public? Somebody who really impresses people with the strength of his argumentation and of the principle he's standing up for, and who makes friends in other states while doing it, even while losing on the issue, or somebody who says outlandish, bombastic things each day, something worse. The rape and pillage remark.
What was the rape and pillage remark?
He said something to the effect that, and it only came. He actually said it apparently in an interview a week ago, and it just came out. Something to the effect of, he basically compared the impact on New York to rape and pillage, I suppose, of the tax bill, apparently. I didn't even bother to read the exact—
By the way, I've heard from an awful lot of women who say to me, never use the word rape on
the— Well, it's kind of like the gender version of comparing something to the Holocaust. You ought to be careful. I think that—but he's done other things. Even if he hadn't done that, the sort of— I think he really jumped the shark when he urged New York's congressional representatives to oppose it and then demanded that the people who voted against it resign, which was basically the triumph of just like shrill partisan invective
over any other kind of reasonable
approach to the issue.
Yeah, we had a lot of Republican Congress people, two of whom, Stefanik and Faso, who were both, had some political risk, although I would say Faso more, and they voted against it. And then he criticized them and said, you should resign.
Right. Obviously it was on the face of it, just ridiculous. So let's put it again, if you're running for national office, what will impress people more? The way he has handled this issue, I would ask you, is this going to favorably impress people around the country? I mean, it may leave the echo of the, volume set at 11 noise associated with his reaction to this. When those people in New York who don't get anything out of this or even find themselves hurt by it, look back on this, will they think, well, I remember he yelled about it, so he's on my side. But what does it do nationally?
Yeah. I want to ask you, move on there, EJ, all good points, to the $4 billion debt, which we know we have in New York. Here's a governor who has to run for governor in 2018. This is not a healthy situation for him to be in.
Well, it's very interesting because their revenues have kind of fallen out of bed, mainly among the high-income payers, well below projections. The best explanation anybody can come up with, including his own budget division, is that it's uncertainty among high-income payers over what they're, including owners of pass-through business entities, over what the tax law is going to be and how it's going to affect them.
So?
Well, I think that actually when the bill passes, whatever happens, assuming it does pass, which seems very likely, there will still be a lot of uncertainty. I talked to a major tax accountant downstate today. It was a lot of clients in this niche, and he's not sure what to advise them based on what he's seen so far. It's going to be on the one hand, on the other hand.
Now, some of them are moving out of New York State. They're going down to Florida.
Well, that's been happening for years.
The increase seems to be there.
I think there's little disagreement on the issue that the only impact on the existing out-migration of very high-income people will be that there'll be an increase. To what extent, how big an increase and how quickly it happens is the only question. But that's been documented. I've tracked it through tax data myself. I mean, we've got, and this is generational, the wealthiest people are all baby boomers who are thinking of retirement anyway. You can keep your tie to New York. You can move to Florida, keep some business ties to New York, not live here, and not completely disappear, but protect your nest egg, which in the case of these folks is millions of dollars, from New York taxation. And that's what they do, more than half of them.
Now, we do know that Governor Cuomo has tried to make a reputation by doing economic development.
Right.
We do know, as you have just acknowledged, that we have $4 billion of extra debt in New York.
Well, a budget gap of $4
budget
million.
Budget gap. There are those people, EJ, who are saying this is all a bunch of phony maloney, this development stuff, and it hasn't worked.
Well, I thought for years under several governors that whenever anybody does anything under the name of, quote, economic development, unquote, it's usually dubious because it usually involves an attempt to force feed or subsidize something that's not happening.
Or FOA, Friends of Andrew.
Or Friends of fill-in-the-blank governor. I mean, basically, there's been some more egregious abuses of it in this administration than we've seen in the past. But, you know, I don't think that what he's – that anything he's done in the name of, quote, economic development, unquote, has actually had a significant effect. In fact, to the extent that there was, until recently at least, a small – a bit of an uplift in some of the economic indicators for Buffalo. Just ask anybody in Buffalo. It was related to things that were almost had almost nothing to do with the so-called Buffalo Billion. It was projects that were underway or that were planted before that even got going.
Which E.J. McMahon, I want to point out, we are talking to E.J. McMahon, certainly, if not the most informed of people about the way that our economics work in New York State, certainly right up there. E.J., now you get a governor who has to run for office in 2018, and he has to worry about how he's doing this. He doesn't play well with other people in his sandbox. We know that Tom DiNapoli, who is the comptroller of New York, a man I've always thought very highly of, has been critical of the governor and so back from the governor to Tom DiNapoli. And they did something which I consider to be utterly despicable. They took away his pre-procurement observations of contracts that the state was about to enter into. I understood where the governor was doing it. You know, he just doesn't like DiNapoli, but I never understood why the legislature went along with him.
Well, institutionally, personalities aside, any governor would love to have the comptroller less involved in his in overseeing anything he's doing. That's a perennial thing. I do think procurement reform, which was a priority of a lot of us this past year, needs to be a top priority again in this session. There's really no excuse for not doing the kind of basic procurement reform that was proposed basically on a bipartisan basis in the legislature last year. It has major support from Republican senators and from Democrats in the Assembly and in the Senate as well. And the governor basically blocked it.
So what doesn't the legislature say? Hey, you really did a bad thing here. Most people are getting the idea of what you did. What is with them?
I think that one of the great stories of our time, or big stories of our time in Albany, is institutionally the institutional weakening of the legislature, which is mainly the legislature's own doing. I think the legislature has conceded far too much authority and initiative to the governor in ways that would have been, between us old guys, unbelievable from 30 or 40 years ago. And, you know, you can remember the leaders I'm talking about in both parties.
Sure.
By the way, 30 years ago this year, when in the wake of the real sweeping, significant, positive federal tax reform of 1986, all four conferences of the legislature put out really interesting, solid, substantive, carefully thought out tax reform plans, took the initiative from the governor, who had barely proposed much of anything, then Mario Cuomo. And the resulting tax reform we did in 1987 was very much driven by, on a bipartisan basis, by the legislature. And it's if a similarly important sweeping federal reform had happened now, you wouldn't for a minute expect even one of those conferences, much less all four of them, to behave in a similar manner. They just don't have the oomph or the institutional awareness or have to do anything like that anymore.
E.J. McMahon, you're brilliant on this stuff, so I want to ask you a question. What economic reforms do you think we should do in New York right now?
Well, the main thing that we need to do in response to this federal tax change is it's the old physician's motto, you know, do no harm, or modify, do no more harm. I think that the biggest problems we have are aside from taxes, regulatory issues. And I think that we could discuss them at length. I think what the governor has done on energy policy, what he's done on public works contracting policy, what he's done in environmental policy have all hindered economic growth in New York, particularly in upstate New York, and that those policies need to be addressed.
Examples?
Well, I would, for starters, let's just take one that I've done. I did a major report on last year that we're going to be supplementing in the weeks ahead. The governor has a strong political alliance with building trades unions and has pushed for expansion of the prevailing wage law. The prevailing wage law is a misnomer. It involves compensation. It's neither prevailing nor limited to wages. It basically is serving increasingly to bail out failing union pension and welfare funds.
And let's define it for a moment, EJ.
And the prevailing wage says that that construction that on public works projects funded by the state and or government and throughout New York, you have to pay the quote-unquote prevailing wage, the wage prevailing, which, by the way, is not just pay but supplemental benefits, the whole package, that is prevailing in that region if at least under any union contract that covers at least 30% of the workers in that union in that region. There's virtually nowhere in the state where that 30% measure actually applies, and everybody knows it. And the Labor Department basically makes it up, doesn't show its work. And this is used as a way to basically steer work to union union firms that couldn't otherwise compete for it,
and to get union votes as well.
And I think that, well, there's no question about it. They held up the affordable housing tax abatement program in New York for 2 years while the governor tried to graft this onto that. This is a really damaging and very expensive policy that adds on average 15 to 20, over roughly 20% to the cost of public works. In New York State. It's a major problem. The scaffold law, which is an absolute liability law unique in the nation, scaffold law imposes absolute liability on a contractor or a site owner when anybody working on a construction project falls from a height, height.
So you, if you live on 89th Street in New York or 96th Street in New York, you see these scaffolds put up mandatorily, right? Everybody has to do this.
Well, it's not just a scaffold, though. It's like any fall from a height. You're on a ladder up three steps. You could be a worker, and the absolute liability means you come back from a three-beer lunch, a little bit woozy, you get up three steps on the ladder, you fall, hurt yourself, you can sue. And the owner of the site and the contract, your employer, have absolute liability for your injury. There's not shared liability. There's not comparative negligence applied. It's a very extreme law. It adds significantly to insurance liability costs in New York. That's something. I think there's a significant amount of the legislature for changing it. By the way, the governor has said that he's for changing it. Well, it needs to change. We need change in our laws involving collective bargaining and public employment, which is really what drives local and ultimately state taxes in New York. Why is New York so different? Why are taxes so high here? The fundamental reason, the main single largest driver of that is the cost of our public employees and our whole public bargaining system.
You wrote in a column, we only got about 2 minutes to go, but you wrote in a column that Trump was right about woes of upstate New York and that Cuomo was wrong. What did you mean?
Well, that was after a quote when Trump had complimented or maybe even gone out to Wisconsin. I forget when there's some Chinese firm was opening up a plant in Wisconsin. Trump said something like, these people in parts of the country, and he mentioned upstate New York, which he calls Upper New York, oddly, that they leave in these failing regions and they go to places like this. He said something to that effect. The governor and other Democrats in New York immediately reacted, how dare you suggest such a thing? And what I was saying was, and I hardly agree with Trump in nuance or substance on anything, but what he said made perfect sense. People will need to go where there are jobs. If there's not new jobs in upstate New York, people need to go where the jobs are. And in fact, the Wisconsin project is a bad project. It's actually Cuomo-esque, done by a Republican governor, Scott Walker. It's this sort of bad thing we usually specialize in doing. They threw a lot of money at this company and it went to Wisconsin. But the point was, you need to create a climate here that is more conducive to growth and to investment. And that's not what's happening. Instead, we're throwing money at favored developers and calling it success.
We only have a few seconds left now. EJ McMahon, is the sky falling in?
No, the sky's not falling, but I think that generally the tax overhaul is going to be very disruptive, especially mainly downstate, not upstate.
Where the money is.
That's where the money is. I think it's going to disrupt the residential real estate market. It's going to disrupt and confound a lot of people there. And it remains to be seen how severe an impact it has. It may be moderate. It may be more long term. We don't know. I wouldn't overstate it. All I'd say is it's a negative for New York.
Well, the president says he wouldn't be surprised to see our GDP rise to 6%. You have a certain doubt about
that? I would be shocked if that happened. So I don't think that's going to happen.
We are out of time. Our guest has been E.J. McMahon, adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute and research director of the Empire Center for Public Policy, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank based in Albany, New York. E.J., you're always wonderful and always welcome here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.